Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Liz Martin.
And today's episode is on pterosaur aerodynamics. But before we get into that, just want to announce that the voting for the annual podcast awards show is now over. So thanks to everyone that voted over the last few weeks. It really, really is appreciated. And to be one of the world's top 10 educational podcasts, I think that's something that we're all very, very proud of.
Yeah, definitely.
So Liz, how have you been?
I've been good. I've spent the last week in Wales demonstrating on a geology field trip.
So nice.
That was fun and also exhausting with 100 first-year undergraduates.
That's a lot of people to teach geology.
Yeah. So we were split into groups, so I only had 45 in my group, but it's still a lot.
That's quite a lot. Was it all like sedimentary geology, or was there a bit of paleo in there as well?
Mostly sedimentary, a little bit of igneous and a little bit of paleo. So there were some trilobite fossils and some brachiopods and bivalves. So got a little bit of paleo in when I could.
Well, it's important to know sedimentology for any paleontologist, because that is the context in which we find our fossils.
Mm-hmm.
So I should be on a paleontology field trip today. I was due to be driving the minibus for Bristol University, but I've torn a muscle playing football.
Well done.
Thank you. some wonderful sympathy there. You're so empathetic. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, what can I say? It's what happens when you spend a week with undergrads in the field. You lose.
So you must have had some pretty good field trips in your time, not always teaching students.
Yeah, I have had a couple. I've managed to do a couple of trips in Canada, which has always been fun, and Romania.
So was Canada with Phil Curry?
Yes. Yeah. I've done two or three field trips with him.
Nice. And what were you doing in Romania?
Romania is a trip we do with Southampton, so with my university. We go each year and look for basically whatever fossils we can find in the Hatzig Basin. Specifically for me, it's looking for pterosaur stuff because it's very rich in pterosaur fossils. So that makes it much fun for me.
And that leads us right back into the subject of today's interview. It's almost like we scripted this or something.
Yeah, something like that.
So we are talking today about pterosaur aerodynamics. So who are we speaking to? Or who are you speaking to, I should say?
So Colin is a colleague of mine and also one of my supervisors. So I, of course, really enjoyed this episode. Not that I'm biased at all, but I hope that you enjoy it too. Hi, Colin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So you are not, I guess, what most people would call a traditional paleontologist. So how did you get into paleontology?
Well, it's quite a long story. I mean, I've always been generally interested in it. My parents lived in Hunstanton. I used to go and collect brachiopods in the cliffs at Hunstanton and things like that. And I was aware of that depth of time, if you like. But I'd made my living doing other things. I was an engineer by training. I set up wind energy companies. I'd done a number of different things in my life, but reached a point where I had an opportunity to do something completely different. And at that time, I was living in Bristol and with my wife, Pamela Gill, who is a well-known paleontologist, and also got to know Mike Benton in the department where Pam was doing her PhD. And sort of one thing led to another, and I just got more and more interested in the subject and was fortunate in having the opportunity to do a PhD there.
You work primarily on pterosaurs. Mm-hmm. So what got you interested specifically in pterosaurs?
Well, there was some students at Bristol doing a project on pterosaurs, which involved the use of a wind tunnel. And they their supervisor who was helping them with that left the university. And Pam told me about their position, that they didn't really know how to carry on with their project. And I have in the past, amongst other things, run wind tunnels. So I started helping them with their project and just found I was really fascinated by pterosaurs. And I was at the time looking for a subject to do my own work and thought, well, what I should look at is the flight of pterosaurs.
So that started initially with wind tunnels.
Yeah.
How can you use wind tunnels to understand a flying, or I guess an extinct flying animal? How does that kind of
work? I mean, all a wind tunnel is doing is recreating reality at a smaller, manageable scale. So obviously you have to have a reconstruction of the animal in question in order to test it in a wind tunnel. So that relies on having reasonable quality fossil evidence. Okay. But the thing about a wind tunnel is you can look at a number of variations. So if you're not quite sure about the fossil interpretation, you can look at a number of different options and see how they perform, and perhaps then draw conclusions about which one therefore was most likely.
Of course, this is a bit more of an engineering technique than a traditional paleontological method. Normally, paleontology is based on biology or geology. So how can you use other engineering methods to further understand the past? And
well, if you like, at a very simple level, the biology gives you the shape of the organism, but its behavior, but doesn't necessarily tell you much about the actual functional side of it. So the engineering, the physics starts to allow you to understand the functional morphology, the reasons why things are the shape they are, you know, in terms of their strength, their ability to perform certain functions.
And related to flight, most often, if you look at a paper, they talk about the aerodynamics. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of explain in more easy to understand terms exactly what aerodynamics is and what it tells us about an animal or about a plane?
Well, I mean, aerodynamics, I suppose, is at its most basic is the flow of air around a structure, whether it be a building, an aeroplane, a pterosaur, or a bird. And what you're trying to do is to understand the interaction between that structure and the airflow around it. And incidentally, it's exactly the same arguments for water flow, but we can come to that later. So aerodynamics is about how those things work in the air. So in the case, say, of something that flies, how does it actually use the air in order to generate sufficient forces to stay up in the air? Those forces are called lift. And aerodynamics enables you to analyze the efficiency with which things produce lift. And it tells you something about their flight capability. And equally, it allows you to analyze the resistance to motion. Any body going through the air creates what's called drag, resistance to motion. And the aerodynamics allows you to analyze that and to understand what particular aspects of the shape of the morphology are contributing to that drag.
People have been looking at trying to understand flight in the fossil record, in particular in pterosaurs, for many years. But how do your methods and what you've been looking at, how does that differ from previous studies and what people have done in the past?
Well, I mean, some people, for example, there's an extraordinarily good paper by Bramwell and Whitfield in 1973, where they looked at the aerodynamics of Pteranodon, and they did very much the same sort of approach as I've been using. So I'm not the first person to do this. And there was an interesting collaboration because Terry Bramwell was a paleontologist and Whitfield was the aerodynamicist, the engineer. Okay. And they obviously worked together on this and produced what I think is a seminal paper. But that was then, this is now. We now have access to much more information than they did. So what I'm doing is bringing in all I know about fluid dynamics, about sail design, about so-called low-speed aerodynamics to try to understand what was going on with pterosaurs. So I'm just adding to what's been done in the past. And without the biology, without the paleontologists, the biologists being able to reconstruct the bodies and tell to get some idea of what these things look like, I wouldn't be able to apply my techniques. But what I can do is set boundaries. Engineering aerodynamics enables you to set limits to what was possible. and this might help in terms of understanding the function.
Okay. Of course, pterosaurs were the first flying vertebrates, but are not the only ones. So how do their wings differ from other flying vertebrates, and how does that kind of affect the flight and aerodynamics of the animal?
Okay, well, I mean, obviously they're very different to birds, because birds get the lift surface, the lifting surface is comprised of feathers, so lots of finite units. Pterosaurs are more like bats in that the wing surface is a membrane, but they're different in that that membrane is suspended on one finger, whereas in a bat the hand is spread and the membrane goes between the different fingers. This means that for a pterosaur, the keeping the membrane tight is probably much more demanding physiologically or structurally demanding, which I think you can see in the shape of the wing bones, which form the leading edge of this wing. Other flying vertebrates, things like flying squirrels, they're using a membrane, but it's a very limited flight capability compared to the, if you like, the fully volant animals like birds and pterosaurs and bats.
So you mentioned that the structure of the wing bone of the pterosaurs, or the wing bones, can reflect the difficulty they would have had in keeping the membrane
tight.
Yeah, tight. So how does that structure tell you that? What is the structure of it that makes it?
We're fortunate in having some very well preserved three-dimensional fossils of pterosaur wing bones. So it's possible to look along the complete length of the wing and understand the structural properties as you move along the length. And one of the key properties is the bending stiffness, the resistance to bending. And what you find is that when you start from the from the body and move distally, that initially the wing bones are shaped such that they are very resistant to dorsiventral bending, which is to do probably with limiting the deflection of the tip of the wing, because obviously if the wing folds up too much, it reduces its aerodynamic performance. But as you move more distally towards the first wing phalanx, that actually changes, and there's a sudden shift, and the first wing phalanx is twice as stiff anterior-posteriorly, in other words, in the plane of the membrane, than it is dorsiventrally. And I interpret that as a sign that the structure of the wing bones is being disposed towards resisting a tension force in the membrane. You know, if there's a certain amount of material available, then it's used in the most effective way, and it's being used there in that region to tension the membrane, which suggests that membrane tension was a very important issue, particularly as they got bigger. And there's some work I've been doing looking at flutter in membranes, and that certainly seems to be the case, that if you have a large span of unsupported membrane, as we know, let's say looking at flags and things, the only way to stop it flapping is to have tension in it. And that can only come from effectively bending in the wing bone. So think of it a little bit like a bow and arrow. You know, you're bending the bow and you're putting tension in the string. Similarly, we're doing that, or the pterosaurs doing that, with the wing membrane.
With the wing membrane, of course, soft tissue is quite rare in the fossil record, at least in the vertebrate fossil record. So is there any kind of empirical way of knowing what the membrane would have been made of, how that membrane would have been supported, or are there any ideas of how the membrane was kept stretched and stiff?
Well, as you know, there's a lot of discussion amongst the paleontologists about the actual composition of the membrane. One of the things that does seem to be the case is there was some sort of reinforcing fibres in particularly the distal regions of the wing membrane, so-called actinofibrils. There's a lot of discussion about exactly what they were and what their orientation was. But they do appear to have been present and provided some sort of reinforcing. What I've been able to do from an engineering point of view is to say, well, if you have a membrane and you say it must be constrained so it doesn't flutter, because we know that if a fluttering flag has much, much higher drag than one that's not fluttering, so it seems highly unlikely that pterosaurs flew around with their membranes fluttering. And the only mechanism they've got for stopping that is tension. And therefore, you can, if you make some estimates of the membrane weight distribution, you can work out what stiffness is required, or tensile stiffness is required in the membrane in order to stop it fluttering. And I've done that, and what that implies is that the membrane couldn't have been made of skin and muscle, as in the case of bats. It just would have been too stretchy and ballooned out and just not provided the tensile properties required to stop it fluttering. So it must have had some sort of higher tensile reinforcing in it, which is where the fibres come in, because they probably could have been made of keratin, which is a much higher modulus material than skin and muscle and tendon. And so most likely that's why those fibres were there. So engineering allows us to sort of say something must have been there, or we would expect it, and indeed we know from the fossil record it probably was the case. So the two things tie up.
Have you looked at flight in all sizes of pterosaurs? Is this something that's kind of something that's found in all pterosaurs, or is this more of a large pterosaur, small pterosaur?
I've limited my research to larger animals, partly because I think that's an interesting area, just how they could get that big. The largest extant birds are 3.5 meters wingspan. It seems that pterosaurs were commonly twice that, and some monsters, of course, perhaps more still. So how did they do it? What was special about pterosaurs that enabled them to become as large as this? So that's been part of the thrust of my research, and therefore why I've not been looking at the smaller animals. The smaller ones probably flapped a great deal more than the big ones, different aerodynamics, more complex in fact, and yes, would be interesting to look at, but you know, there's only so many hours in the day. I can't do everything. I'd like to look at it, but there's more than enough at the moment on looking at the basic gliding and soaring performance of the big animals.
Focusing on those big pterosaurs, of course, there's these big giants like Hetzegopteryx and Quetzalcoatlus. How big were the biggest ones thought to be?
Well, again, there's a lot of contention about this. Historically, people have made claims of 12 meters or more wingspan. The most recent papers are suggesting clipping their wings somewhat, bringing them down to maybe 10 or 11 meters based on the fossil evidence. Now, of course, this is somewhat sketchy. There's very few bones from the big animals. Mm. So what's happening is people are taking one, say, a large humerus and making estimates of the size of all the remaining bones. You know, there are good paleontological and biological ways of doing that, which are probably reasonably reliable. So, yes, it seems that 10 metres wingspan is very likely.
And with 10 metres, I guess the main question that everybody wants to know is, could it actually fly with a 10-metre wingspan animal that's, of course, been shown to be as tall as a giraffe?
Yeah, and weighing a quarter of a ton.
Yeah.
At 10, 11 metres, the mass estimate, as you well know, is a somewhat variable feast, but the consensus is that animals of that size, as dark as of that size, weighs about 250 kilos. Yeah, and as a paper or presentation that Mike and Habib and I did at SVP last year showed, there are a number of reasons to think that they could well have flown. Certainly, power requirements don't seem to have been an issue. That's often been used as a line of argument for limiting the size of birds, but our analysis suggested that for steady flight, at least, that these large pterosaurs, 11, 12 metres wingspan, could in theory have enough power to fly. The thing that we found that most likely limited their size was the takeoff capability. Because there they have to launch themselves into the air, and that's a very energetic thing to do. And this appeared to be the limiting factor. And although obviously we can't be sure, it appeared that in excess of 10 meters wingspan size of animal, that becomes increasingly difficult. And obviously, for practical purposes, an animal needs a bit of margin for safety. And so the margins were getting pretty slim at 10 meters. So maybe a few individuals of that size were around, but it's not something that perhaps was common.
Can you talk a little bit about pterosaur launching? Of course, Mike Habib has come up with the quadrupedal launch.
Yeah.
So engineering-wise, or looking at it from an engineering perspective, does it hold up? How would a pterosaur have been able to do that?
Well, I'm convinced. I think the quadrupedal launch makes a huge amount of sense. And one of the reasons, one of the key reasons, is that it enables a pterosaur to use the same musculature for takeoff as for flight. By comparison, birds have different, completely separate musculature for flying and walking and leaping. And they, when birds take off, most of their takeoff dynamics comes from their legs, not from their wings. They push off with their legs, get up into the air, and then their wings take over. Once their wings take over, their legs are just payload. They don't need them. They would be better off without them when they're flying. So a bird has to distribute its muscle mass between its flight muscles and its leg muscles. And depending on its behavior, it does that differently. So, for example, something like a bustard has big, strong legs and less strong chest muscles. A swan is the other way around. So, but always it's a compromise, because probably for practical reasons, the mass of the flight muscles plus the leg muscles can't be more than about 30-40% of the total muscle mass, because obviously an animal's got to have other muscles to do things with. So they're separate, these different modules. In pterosaurs, they're more combined, because most of the takeoff force comes from the forelimbs, and those, of course, are the same limbs that are used for flying. So the animal recruits the muscles for takeoff and then uses those same muscles for flying, which means that it can devote a higher proportion of muscle mass to one or other function, because it's the same muscles. And this, we think, is one of the keys to how they could get larger. And that relies on the quadrupedal launch, pushing off with your forelimbs.
A lot of pterosaur fossils come from marine environments.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they would have been able to launch from the water using their wings?
I haven't given this a great deal of thought, but personally I'm skeptical, though I know there are others who think it was possible. I don't know. All I know, if you like, and this is purely anecdotal, is from trying to learn to windsurf and things, that if you have a windsurfer rig on the sea, which is rather like akin to a pterosaur wing, getting it up out of the waves is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Now, I know you've got to be careful reading those things in, but it doesn't strike me as something that an animal like a pterosaur would want to do very often. However, I've recently seen a video of an owl which fell in the water taking off.
Yeah.
So animals are capable of extraordinary things, which you might at first sight think of as impossible. But I would, in terms of modern analogues, I would prefer to think of something like a frigate bird as an analogue for the marine pterosaurs. That it makes its frigate bird makes its living over the sea, but actually mostly dies if they actually fall in the sea, because their plumage can't handle it, in the case of the frigate bird, rather than, say, the albatross, which other people have used as an analogue, which spends a great deal of its time sitting on the sea surface and diving and fishing and things. Those animals are very different morphologically to pterosaurs, and I think the relative, if you like, the surface area to weight ratio of pterosaurs and things would make it very difficult for them to manage on the sea surface and to take off from it.
Another unique characteristic of pterosaurs is the pteroid bone.
Mm-hmm.
How does the pteroid come into flight? How is that? Of course, the pteroid bone is a wrist bone, kind of. How does that relate to pterosaur flight?
Well,
When
I, in about 2005, 2006, when I sort of entered the world of pterosaurs, there was a great deal debate about the orientation of the pteroid. There were people informed by, you know, people who knew a lot about biology who seemed to think that the pteroid pointed forwards, pointed anteriorly, and therefore was able to support a large area of wing membrane. There were others who didn't believe that was the case, and it was quite a heated debate, shall we say. I looked at it more from an engineering point of view than from the anatomy of the attachment, and came down in favour of the pteroid pointing medially. Structurally, it just didn't make sense to me that it would point anteriorly, and it's a bit complicated in 5 minutes to explain the reasons, but there's a number of reasons in the paper why I'm pretty convinced that the pteroid couldn't possibly have pointed anteriorly. But it does beg the question of what it was for. And I think it was to do with having leading edge tension in the membrane between the wrist and the body. And it's a way of maintaining that tension. And given that if there's a bone there, it could be articulated, it would mean that the animal would be able to have some control over the camber of the wing in that region, which is could be useful for landing for low-speed flight. Because one of the things that another thing that differentiates, as I forgot to mention, that differentiates pterosaurs from birds is the ability to have considerable control over the camber of the wing membrane. Camber is the curvature. The more curvature there is in it, that's anterior posterior curvature, the slower, all other things being considered, the slower the animal can fly. And this, I think, also contributes to the fact that the animals could get big, because it meant that they could have variable speed. They could take the camber out of the wing for fast flying, but still manage to slow down enough not to hurt themselves when they land. Whereas if you think of something like a swan or an albatross, they struggle with landing unless they can do it on water. They don't like landing on hard things because they just can't slow down enough, because they can't vary either the area of the wing, which pterosaur can't do, or the camber, which the pterosaur can do.
That reminds me of a question I was going to ask about landing. Mm-hmm. So if all of the muscles are in the wing side for both takeoff and flight, how would that affect landing if their pelvis isn't very kind of muscle strong, if they can't do anything really on that end? I can imagine that landing would be difficult, especially for a large pterosaur.
Yeah, I think the landing dynamics is an interesting area and very poorly understood and not an easy one to model. However, when you look at many birds, when they land, they with just a gentle headwind, they don't even move their legs. They just come into land. They do what's called flare. They pitch up their body, and they effectively stall a little way above the ground and just drop vertically. And I think pterosaurs are perfectly capable of doing that. Okay. So they don't need to be able to run off the landing speed if there's a light headwind. Now, of course, in the absence of any wind, they would be landing at maybe 4 or 5 meters a second. So there would be a need to walk as they landed. But given that they had some mobility on the land, quadrupedally, I can't see why it's necessarily a problem. But it's another potential limiting factor, because as they got bigger, it does seem the landing speeds increased. So there must come a point at which they started hurting themselves.
Yeah. I think there's a trackway that is interpreted as a landing trackway, where it shows, I don't know how big the pterosaur is, but it shows it coming in bipedally and then after a few steps going down to four and carrying on. And I think that's been interpreted as a landing track.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, again, it's anecdotal, but I used to fly paragliders, and they, you know, coming as a human coming into land, I didn't want to come in too fast. But even with a very moderate headwind, if you get it right, you can do this pitching up and you just drop onto your feet. And that's obviously the wingspan there is comparable with a big pterosaur. So you've got to be careful with these extrapolations. But it would seem to be physically possible to do that.
Of course, I could talk about pterosaurs all day.
Join the club.
But apparently they're not the only extinct flying animals.
Maybe the best.
I know that you've done some work on other early flyers, like Microraptor. Can you tell us a little bit about that study and what you found about Microraptor?
Yes, I was fortunate to be able to collaborate with Gareth Dyke and others here at Southampton. And what we did there was we reconstructed Microraptor and built a full-size model, because there's very good wind tunnel facilities at Southampton. And we put that full-size model into the wind tunnel in order to measure the complete range of flight characteristics. That's not flapping flight, but gliding flight characteristics. So we can measure the lift and drag over a range of orientations and a range of possible morphologies, because there's some debate about the how far the hind limbs could spread. So we looked at two or three different orientations of the hind limbs. And what we really found was that for a gliding flight where you're just leaping out of a tree, aerodynamic efficiency is not very important. There's always a tendency to think that lift drag ratio efficiency is what matters. But if you're up in a tree and you just want to glide down to the ground or glide to the next tree ballistically, in other words, you push off with your legs and you just go using gravity to accelerate you, you're better off to have just a relatively inefficient aerofoil system that just creates a lot of lift and drag. And this enables you to travel better in that restricted, cluttered environment. And so it's said that, I think quite interestingly, that there aren't necessarily strong evolutionary pressures early on to get the maximum aerodynamic efficiency. You know, any old feathered wing will do and give you some behavioural benefits.
Have you done any work on other early flying dinosaurs, or is Microraptor the only one you've looked at so far?
Yeah, certainly the only one I've looked at. I mean, I've talked with Gareth a lot about the evolution of flight in other birds, and I'm generally interested in that area, but not done any specific work on it yet. And we're starting to do a bit of work here on feathers and looking at that, because clearly the evolution of feathers as a flight surface is key to the evolution of birds.
But bird evolution isn't as interesting as pterosaurs.
Well, pterosaurs got there first.
True. If you can do these sort of experiments in wind tunnels, is there something similar you can do in the water, looking at extinct swimming things?
Well, yes, and I think is that from a fluid dynamics point of view, you can test models of things that go in the air in water and vice versa. It's a matter of what's called Reynolds number and getting the scaling right. But, you know, it's not been unknown for people to test models of aircraft in water tanks. It just depends on what you're trying to find out experimentally. So, yes, of course. And we've got a PhD student here at Southampton who's working on plesiosaur hydrodynamics using a water tank. But he could be doing those experiments in air, in fact. It's just that we've got the right facilities here using water, but those tests could be done in air just as much, although the actual animal, of course, lived in the water.
What kind of limitations exist for using these kind of experimental studies in paleontology and applying those to extinct animals?
I think one of the big issues is that this sort of experimental work is pretty time costly, and certainly making changes can be difficult, and therefore it makes it difficult to look at a range of different options. And often, because in paleontology we don't know the exact morphology, what we're looking at is exploring the possibilities of different morphologies. There's a limit to what you can do in practical terms for money and time in wind tunnels or water tanks to look at a range of parameters. And that's where I think it's really exciting is the rise of techniques like computational fluid dynamics, which enable you to have a wind tunnel in a computer. Now, the techniques are not perfect, and ultimately a wind tunnel or a water tunnel is gives you the best single point results. Mm. But if you want to look at a range of possibilities, you can maybe calibrate your, use your water tunnel results or your wind tunnel results to calibrate a CFD model. Then you can look at a range of different parameters. And those, although it's still computationally fairly demanding, you can run a number of parameters that way. And I think that's going to be very exciting in the future as those techniques become more readily available. You know, as we know, people have been using finite element analysis mm-hmm. in the analysis of fossils for a long time now. People like Emily Rayfield in Bristol have been spearheading that. And that technique allows people to ask lots of what-if questions. Mm. CFD has always been a bit more difficult to use, a bit more complicated, same principles, but more complicated, but it is becoming more accessible. So may allow us to reliably answer more of those what-if questions of flight of extinct organisms.
What other kinds of modern technology has helped with these studies?
Well, it's interesting. Just in the time I've been involved in paleontology, the rise of CT scanning has made a huge impact. When I started my research in 2007 or 8, because I wanted to understand the structure of the bones, I needed to get inside. Now, of course, you know, museum curators are not too keen. You're going along and taking a hacksaw to their wonderful specimens. So all I was able to do was to look at broken specimens and try to work out the cortical thickness from the fractures and things in broken specimens that I was allowed to analyze. And a few people had been able to do thin sections. Lorna Steele, her PhD, had thin sections in it. But it's very limited what you can do that way. Mm-hmm. Now we can take a whole bone, stick in a CT scanner, and a few hours later we've got the distribution of cortical thickness over the whole bone, which means I can then just calculate the bending stiffness of that bone and I've got my structure. So that's made what I'm doing so much easier and more reliable. Mm. The answers are more robust. Which of course is important. So that's been a very big advance. And, you know, with that, the software for processing it, you know, people still swear at Aviso, but it's much easier than it used to be.
The distribution of cortical thickness, how does that affect bending stiffness?
Well, the bending stiffness is a function of what's called the second moment of area, which is essentially the distribution of stuff around the shape.
Okay.
And the two things, the cross-sectional area, the larger the cross-sectional area, all other things being equal, the greater the second moment of area. But the greater the depth of the section, the greater, for the same area, the greater the second moment of area. So, for example, on pterosaur bones, people talk about them being highly pneumatized. Mm. They were thin-walled tubes full of air.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, as an engineer, I see them and immediately see a stiffness-driven structure because the evolution is pushing the material to the extremes. If you go much thinner walled, you end up getting localized buckling. Mm-hmm. So they're getting close to the limit of using the material most efficiently.
And how thin were the bones? What kind of thickness are you talking about?
1-2 millimeters on a 20 millimeter diameter bone.
It's ridiculous.
But think in terms of the fuselage of a jumbo jet next to an airplane. The skin thickness there is probably a couple of millimeters. That's kind of terrifying. Now, the only reason that doesn't buckle is because there's lots and lots of stiffeners.
Yeah.
And to some extent, possibly the trabeculae inside the wing bones on pterosaurs are performing a similar function.
Okay.
They are, because if a structure buckles, it fails a long, long way before all the material has been recruited to resist the bending. So you don't want it to buckle. So you need some way of stopping buckling going on.
So kind of to wrap up at the end, what do you think is the hottest topic of pterosaur flight? What do you think is the next kind of big question?
Well, I think one of the big advances is, as I understand it, the big Quetzalcoatlus fossil is going to be described soon. This is something that's been hanging around. It's been known about. Quetzalcoatlus northropii has been known about for a long, long time, but for one reason or another has not been published and has been very inaccessible except for a chosen few. Mm-hmm. It seems that's now going to be published, and we will at last have a good quality fossil of possibly a 10-meter wingspan Ajdakid. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we'll be able to start to really answer some of these questions about how big these animals actually could have been and could they have flown. Mm. I mean, that's answering a specific question. I feel that for pterosaurs, we're reaching the limits of what we can do at the moment because we know so little about the soft tissue. Mm. We know, you know, we have good data for the wing bones. So, if you like, in terms of engineering terms, we can define the wing spar and strength and things effectively. But we don't know much about the membrane that was hung on the back of it. Mm. And so, a discovery of a well preserved membrane, or rather more well preserved membrane, could really help us go forward, I think. But whether, of course, that'll happen, I don't know. Amazing things are coming out of China, so it might happen.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? And that's very much from my engineering point of view. I can't speak for the other workers in pterosaurs as to where the advances will be. But in terms of what I'm trying to do, I need to know more about the membrane. Mm. I can work out what I think it should have been, but whether it was, we just don't know.
And although I said that was wrapping up, now I have one more question. Mm-hmm. Quetzalcoatlus, you said that this is the kind of most complete large pterosaur that we have. How much of it is there? So I didn't think there was much.
Well, maybe there isn't. This is it. This is what we don't know. I mean, there are photographs around of reconstructions of it and things, but how much of that is people's basing it on smaller animals and scaling it up, making plaster casts? I don't know. That's why it's going to be very interesting and I hope not disappointing. I mean, I rather hope that quite a lot of it's there, but I don't know. Mm. And until it's described, we'll have to wait and see. But the important thing is that it is going to be described, so we will no longer be in the dark about it.
I know. I see in almost every museum that has pterosaur material, there's a reconstruction of a Quetzalcoatlus wing, and it's massive. And I always look at it and think, how much of that do they actually have? Because, I don't know either.
There's been work done on the variation of the morphology of ornithocarid with size. Mm. And it seems that they're quite conserved. So the ratio of the bone lengths remains pretty much constant with increasing animal size. Mm-hmm. So if you can say the same applies to Ajdakids, then if you've got, a well-preserved 3 or 4 metre wingspan individual, with which I think there are a number, then scaling up from just one humerus is probably a reasonably reliable thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Thank you, Colin.
Pleasure.
I have to ask. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. Pleasure.
Well, that was a pretty good episode. I think it's important that we realize that paleontology is such a massive subject that so many different sciences all come together to help us understand about these animals, and aerodynamics is going to be something that's so integral to the ecology of pterosaurs that this is the kind of thing that we need to be thinking about when considering them.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's important that people know that paleontology isn't just going out into the field and looking for fossils. Although that being said, when this episode comes out, I will in fact be in Romania looking for giant pterosaur fossils. So that's still an important part as well.
It's coming out in a couple of days, and you didn't mention that before.
Yeah, it didn't really occur to me, but I will actually be in Romania in 2 days. It's hard when I just got back from Wales to remember that in 2 days I will be going to Romania as well. So,
and will Colin be joining you?
Not this year, no. Colin is not coming this year, unfortunately.
And are you hopeful of finding some giant Asdarchids?
Well, I'm hopeful of finding pterosaurs. I mean, we find pterosaurs basically every time you go out into the field in this area, you'll find pterosaurs, but usually it's just little bits and pieces. So I'm sure we'll find something.
Are they normally disarticulated and smashed up because of their tiny little hollow bones?
Yeah, and you often find kind of one half of one bone, and then maybe a little bit later you'll find a bit of something else. Unfortunately, you don't get nice, complete pterosaurs, but still got my fingers crossed. Maybe this year it'll be a complete giant pterosaur.
And do they find complete ones there?
No, not. There's some kind of partial skeletons.
Mm-hmm.
So there is one called Eurasdarko, which is known from a partial skeleton. So there's like a couple of wing bones and a few vertebra and I think some leg material as well.
Okay.
We'll be going to the site where that's from. So who knows? Maybe we'll find something else.
Well, fingers crossed. Make sure you tell us what you find when you're next on.
Oh, yeah, I definitely will.
And we'll see you all then.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.